Down there, politics is irrelevant. That's what Dexter Filkin says about the reality of life on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he evokes a sense of what that's like in his new book, The Forever War. Mr. Filkins is a foreign correspondent for The New York Times and has covered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to this show today. Hello.
Hi.
Weren't you covering stories in the area even before 2001?
I was. I remember it was a Friday morning, a Friday afternoon, a sunny day, and I went to the Kabul Sports Stadium in September 1998, and I watched a public amputation and an execution. And
had you been invited to do that?
Yes, I was a special guest. They actually brought me to midfield so I could get sort of a better view.
And what was the Taliban trying to prove by inviting you to see that?
Well, it was hard to get a visa back in those days. And, you know, here it was, 1998. It was 3 years before 9/11. And I remember just kind of sitting there saying to myself, my God, who are these people?
It must be difficult to prepare yourself to witness something like that.
Yeah.
Can you inure yourself?
Yeah, yeah. I certainly, you know, since then, I mean, that was 10 years ago. I mean, I've seen, you know, scenes like that so many times now that it's like anything. You know, you've just become a little numb.
Well, if you see a firefight, this is something that suddenly happens. But this is – but an execution, a public execution, beheadings and cutting off hands and the like,
yeah,
that's something that's planned out.
Yes. It was a very elaborate ceremony. You know, they were reading from the Quran, and I remember the phrase that they read was, in revenge there is life. You know, and they said that several times.
Maybe that was the message they wanted to get across to readers of the New York Times.
They did, as well as to the people of Afghanistan, yes.
You note that in the summer of 2000, you said to your editors about Afghanistan, something really bad is going to happen here.
Yes.
What were the signals that you were responding to?
Well, it was that part of the world. And again, you know, nobody knew a thing. I certainly didn't know a thing. But Afghanistan, Pakistan, there were so many bad things happening. And just as an example, I remember 1999 sitting in the far north of Afghanistan with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was one of the few anti-Taliban warlords left. Really amazing guy, you know, fluent in French.
Assassinated by an emissary from Osama bin Laden.
2 days before 9/11, yes. And this was 2 years before 9/11. And I remember standing on the front lines with him, looking. You could see the Taliban on the other side of the mountain. And he said, you know, that the movement's being taken over by Arabs. And he said, we can hear the Arabs speaking on the radio every night. They've got Pakistanis in their ranks. It's the only thing that keeps them going. And I remember being really skeptical about that. You know, I remember thinking, well, you probably would say that because you're hanging by a thread here. But there it was, you know, 2 years before it happened.
Had you heard the name Osama bin Laden at that point and al-Qaeda?
I had, because I'd been in Pakistan when the embassies in Africa were blown up in 1998. You know, if you remember, killed 225 people. And so, in fact, it was a funny conversation. I happened to be in the Marriott Hotel in Islamabad, Pakistan. The embassies were blown up in Africa. And I remember my editor called from Los Angeles then and said, you keep your eye out for a guy named Osama bin Laden.
What was your assignment at the time, to cover that area?
Yeah. Yeah. I was based in Delhi. And, you know, India was supposed to be the focus. But, you know, as the sort of the clouds gathered, I spent more and more time in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
And then with the invasion, the role of journalists changed totally. Did you become one of the embedded journalists?
Well, not then. I mean, when 9/11 happened, you know, I had been to Afghanistan at that point several times, so they sent me back, and I had to go to Tajikistan, into this tiny little piece of territory that was not held by the Taliban. And back then, you know, there weren't any American troops on the ground, so basically I was hanging out with the Northern Alliance and watching. The Americans were mostly in the air dropping bombs.
You couldn't have gone to the other side at that point. It was too dangerous?
Yeah. I mean, I think what changed fundamentally, and it's never changed back, is that, you know, journalists, particularly Western journalists, became targets. You know, so they started killing Western reporters. And of course, you know, I think we're up to more than 150 in Iraq. But right away in the Afghan war in 2001, you know, they killed several, you know, I think pretty close to a dozen, I think, before the year was out.
Well, you were a rarity at the time, and then the place was flooded with journalists, and now there are only a few again. How has the fluctuating number of journalists covering the story affected the way what we know of what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, it's very strange. I mean, if you look at Iraq, I mean, I just think back to when the invasion happened and when Baghdad fell, you know, April 2003. There must have been 5,000 reporters there then, you know. And now, I mean, because of the danger and because of the cost, because you've got to protect everybody, and you know, the New York Times spends, just as an example, $3 million at least a year on the bureau there, 40 or 50 armed guards around the clock. I mean, most people can't afford that, but there's just a few dozen reporters there left, you know. And if you look at Afghanistan, all through the years, you know, 2001 to 2008, there were hardly any reporters there at all. And of course, we see now what's happened is that Afghanistan is slipping again.
We often talk to Sarah Chase, who lives in Afghanistan in Kandahar.
She's a brave woman.
She's a former journalist. And her reports are so different, at such variance from what we get from other reporters, that I wonder whether reporters get the whole story or whether anyone can get the whole story.
Well, I mean, it's a complicated place. I mean, she's basically in the heart of the Taliban. I mean, that's Kandahar is you know, where they were born, and it's the place where they're the strongest.
My guest is Dexter Filkins of The New York Times. His latest book, The Forever War, published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. This book is largely the stories of people there, both soldiers and the residents of the area. Now, how do you get that close? Well, first of all, talking to the residents, you had to do much of this with translators, didn't you?
A lot of it, yeah, sure.
Are they ready? For example, I would assume that in Afghanistan, people are always a bit wary of an American.
Actually, no. I mean, they couldn't be more friendly, frankly, in Afghanistan or Iraq. I think what happened over the years was it became dangerous for them to be seen talking to us. And so, I mean, I remember people, you know, by 2005, 2006 in Iraq, when it was so dangerous, I could call somebody on the phone and say, hey, you know, I want to come over again. I haven't seen you in a while. And there'd be, you know, long pause on the phone. Too dangerous, you know, stay away, you know.
Because they felt like they were being watched. Didn't your translator once prevent you from being kidnapped?
Yeah. It's Wazir Jaff, and he's a wonderful guy. He actually lives in New York now. He's a Kurd, former Peshmerga guerrilla. Yeah, and we were sitting there one day talking to a Sunni sheikh, and this long conversation ensued in Arabic. So, you know, I could only follow one or two words. Got a little heated, and afterwards I said, Jaff, what were you guys talking about? You know, and he said, well, he wanted to kidnap you.
And he talked him out of it.
Well, he persuaded him out of it. He said, you know, my tribe is a lot bigger than your tribe, and don't even think about it.
You write that by being in Iraq as a reporter, you were privy to many things that American officials and soldiers weren't. Why was that?
Well, I mean, as a reporter, you're not a combatant. You know, I don't have a uniform. I don't have a gun. And so often people would say things to me that they wouldn't say that the Americans wouldn't say to the Iraqis or that the Iraqis wouldn't say to the Americans. And so, for example, one of the examples in the book is I'm driving along with a guy named Jonathan Rosh, and we're in, you know, bouncing along in a Humvee along the Euphrates River, and he's doling out money. Christopher Rosh is his name. We're doling out money for dam repairs. And, of course, the Iraqis are happy to take the American cash. They're, thank you, we love America. And the Americans are happy to give out the cash. And I remember as Lieutenant Rosh went back up to his Humvee, I stayed back with the Iraqis. And I turned to them and I said, so what do you think of these guys? You know, what do you think of the Americans? And they didn't hesitate. They said, we hate them. You know, we're going to try to drive them out of the country. We're going to do everything we can. They're the occupiers.
And what can you do with that knowledge? You can write a newspaper article, but do you then go back to Lieutenant Rosh and say, you know, those people hate you?
Yeah, you can do that.
And then what can he do with that information?
Well, you know, when you're talking about American officers, you know, they're very, very smart. And this wasn't a surprise to him. It's just a view. It's like you see – it's a parallel universe that existed. And as I say in the book, there were two conversations in Iraq. There was a conversation they were having between the Americans and the Iraqis and the conversation they were having with themselves. And I think the Americans were aware of it. They just didn't get to see it very often.
You're right that sometimes you'd be talking to an Iraqi when the conversation would suddenly take a turn and they would tell you everything.
Yes.
Why do you think that happened?
Well, I think Iraq is such an extraordinarily traumatized place. And I think if you had to, you know, if I had to tell, say, one thing to people to understand that country, I would say it's utterly traumatized down to its very core. From so many years of Saddam, every single Iraqi has a story to tell about his brother, about his cousin, about people in his family disappeared, dead, tortured, killed. And it comes out. And so you're just sitting here talking to people. And then, you know, you can be talking to them about, you know, the Constitution or anything. And then suddenly they'll just start telling you what happened to them. And it's astonishing. And then, you know, the tears will flow and story. And you realize all this stuff is just beneath the surface.
Why do you think that didn't have much of an impact on American policy? Were they not telling the officials?
I think they were. I think the Americans were aware of it. I think the point that I was trying to make in writing about it was – this is what fell into our laps. I mean, this is what we inherited. I mean, we didn't inherit a normal country. You know, we inherited and I describe it in there. It was like breaking into a mental institution. And I mean that. I say that with great sympathy. It was a place that was so utterly traumatized that was the only way to understand it. It wasn't a normal place.
You also say that you never missed the opportunity to speak with Ahmad Shalabi. Why is that? You say he was Iraq, but from what I understand, Iraqis feel that he is a guy who returned as an opportunist.
He was all those things, and I think that's the short answer.
Well, Chalabi, I always forget how to pronounce his name. Chalabi.
Chalabi is a fascinating guy.
He was a guy who was under indictment in Jordan.
Absolutely, yes. And that's the thing. I mean, he is sort of at once he is brilliant and he is not to be trusted and he keeps, you know, very, very strange allies and he's involved in everything. And so it's a reason to talk to him and it's a reason to be very, very careful.
So you had to put everything through a filter?
Many times, yes.
Figure out what he said was to be believed and what he said was really just spin?
Yes, it was difficult, but that's, you know, that's what being a journalist on the ground in Iraq often amounted to, was, you know, what is this guy telling me and why and what are his motivations?
How much of your time was spent as an embedded reporter?
A lot. I mean, what happened in Iraq, embedding isn't ideal. You know, if I wanted to go to the Sunni Triangle and, you know, talk to a bunch of insurgents or a bunch of American soldiers, in the old days, in 03 and 04, we just get in a car and go, you know. But what happened, of course, was that the country got too dangerous for that. So the only way to go to the Sunni Triangle was to go with American soldiers.
And there's always been a concern that reporters wind up bonding with the soldiers, and that affects the way they perceive what's going on.
Yeah, I mean,
it's us against them.
Well, no. I mean, I think. Yes, you do bond with them. I mean, they're human beings and we're human beings and that's good. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, the human connection is what makes a real story. I think the limitations of embedding are particularly when you're in a place like Iraq is you can't really talk to the Iraqis. You know, you're talking to the Americans and they say, well, you know, we're coming to this village. It's called Zaidan. We think they like us here, but we're not sure. And you can't get out of the Humvee and talk to the Iraqis about it. Or if you do, you're standing next to a bunch of guys with guns. And that's the trouble, you know.
Your book changes scene quickly and you have an epilogue that's set in Fallujah in 2004. Then the first part is in Kabul in 1998. The second part is set in Baghdad from March 2003 on. What made you choose that kind of structure?
Well, I think it's not a linear book, as you say, and it jumps around quite a bit. It goes from one scene to another without a lot of explanation. And I think what I wanted, the whole point of my book was, we've had a lot of books that have explained this war and how it came about and what it means. We haven't had a lot of books that show people what it feels like. And I wanted to write a really visceral book. And
not an intellectual one.
Not an intellectual book. It's an emotional book. And so when you're down on the ground in these places, in the middle of these gigantic events that are unfolding in front of you, that's what it feels like. You know, one day you're having tea with somebody, and the next minute you're getting shot at.
Is this a different way of reporting than what you would send back to the New York Times?
A little, yeah. I mean, the New York Times is a very formal structure, and its primary purpose is to kind of help people make sense of things. And when you write a book, you can basically say whatever you want.
Now, people are going to look at this title, The Forever War, and see a political connotation. But you say that you wanted to leave politics out of the story.
Yes, yes. I think the book very consciously doesn't make any argument whatsoever. Again, it's a book about what it feels like. I think.
But you must have had thoughts about that.
What happens when you go to these places is the politics kind of melt away. And the arguments melt away. And in fact, they don't just melt away. They don't make sense anymore. And so when you're confronted by this enormous reality and the human drama and people dying in front of you and just the stakes so high, and then, you go back to the United States and you listen to some retired colonel in a TV studio, it doesn't make sense.
There's a big disconnect, but I'm sure there was a disconnect right in Iraq. You saw something and then you went to some official briefing and heard that the world was totally different from what you thought it was.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's a whole long section in there about the Green Zone and kind of, this parallel universe that it was, of course. Yeah.
My guest is Dexter Filkins, a foreign correspondent for The New York Times. He's covered the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001. And now he's written a book called The Forever War, published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this. You might want to check out the guest picks section on our show page. We have posted interesting facts about some of our recent guests. For example, did you know that CBS's Bob Schieffer is a country music fan and has written 6 songs that have been recorded? Well, you should go to our show page at WNYC.org and click on guest picks and find out all sorts of interesting information. We're back with Dexter Filkins. He's written a book called The Forever War, published by Knopf. Why did you call it The Forever War? You think this is going to go on forever?
No, not literally. I mean, it feels like forever when you're down there on the ground. And, I was there for so long and we were all waiting. I was certainly waiting for this gigantic thing to kind of resolve itself. And it never did. It was always, Iraq was always like a kaleidoscope. It would just, you'd kind of get a focus on it and then it would just change again.
Yeah. And the things that you could do changed a lot. You're an avid runner, and you run regularly while you were based in Iraq. Rather unusual. There aren't too many Iraqis that run in the morning.
Well, I know nobody was running in the morning at that point.
It gets pretty hot there, doesn't it?
It gets really hot, yeah. I used to carry a liter bottle of water in each hand just to make it through 5 miles.
Did you gain another perspective on the country just by running early in the morning?
I did. I used to run at night, at dusk, and it was a strange thing. The country, particularly, back when we could go anywhere, back in 03 and 04, the country in the day was angry and seething and it was all coming apart and, we could all feel that and see it. And then I'd go out running and it was like that scene in Rocky when, Sylvester Stallone goes into the neighborhood and all the kids go crazy and run after him. It was just the strangest thing.
So I'd be afraid because I would assume somebody would think I was running away from something.
No,
and people do get shot.
Yes, they do, and they get kidnapped. Yeah, I think it was pretty reckless. I mean, I kept running the whole time right up until 2006. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the surge? Did the surge make it easier to run?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, in fact, I was just there, and I just I came back from Iraq on Friday, and the difference is remarkable. I mean, whether it's permanent and whether it's lasting is, of course, something else. But, from day to day, it's the difference is astonishing. It really is.
Because some people have said that part of the success is that we've bought off the insurgents, and
absolutely,
that can only last so long. Well, and we also are seeing any number of people who've been calling for some kind of compromise to be killed. A major leader was the death of a major leader was just in today's times.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's always been true. I mean, anybody who wants to compromise, might as well put a bullseye in the middle of their put it around them. But I think the awakening, which is what you're referring to, there are we've got 100,000 guys, most of them paid about $300 a month on the payroll. It's $30 million a month. A lot of them are former insurgents, and a lot of them would probably be insurgents if they weren't on the payroll. And so it's pretty unstable. But at the same time, as any American officer will point out to you, $30 million, you know, that's not a lot of blown up Humvees and dead American soldiers. I mean, that thing pays for itself as long as it lasts.
How did the places that you could run in, I want to go back to the running for a moment, change over the years? You must have seen changes in the way Baghdad looked over the years.
Yes. I used to run in a place called Abu Nawas Park, which is about a 2-mile stretch along the Tigris River. And in the beginning, you know, back in 2003, I could run, you know, the full 2 miles, you know, loop around, come back. I could get 5 miles out of the thing, and it was fantastic. I go through the neighborhood. And over time, 2004, 2005, 2006, as the country sort of disintegrated into anarchy, my running route shrank down to almost nothing. So that at the end, you know, in the fall of 2006, it was down to like, you know, 500 yards. You know, it had gone from 2 miles, and there was a checkpoint at each end. One of them was Iraqi army, and the other one was these guys that had guns and no uniforms, and they had a poster of Muqtada al-Sadr, and I didn't know where they were from. But they used to let me run, you know, and sometimes—
So you just go back and forth, back and forth?
Back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, it was reckless, but it was about the only thing I could do then that kind of, you know, got my blood flowing.
You write, while you're in Iraq, you might as well have been circling the earth from a space capsule.
Yes.
So what happens when you come back?
It's very strange to come home. It's very strange. I think any reporter or any soldier or diplomat who spent a lot of time over there would tell you that.
I know whenever I'm abroad, I always get a very strange sense of what's going on in the United States. And then I come back and, of course, I'm in the middle of it and I no longer think, have they gone mad? I just think, we're in a lot of trouble. But I'd assume the same sort of thing happens there.
Well, the strange thing about being in Iraq is it's so far away, but it feels even farther. I mean, it feels like you're in a space capsule. It really does. And then to come home from that is so jarring, to go from this extraordinarily violent place where so many things are at stake and people are dying right in front of you. And you come back and, you know, the biggest concern you have is whether they put cheese on your sandwich. And by darn, they better.
So you can – it's a lot easier just to make simple decisions here. You're always unsure when you're there.
Yeah, but it's hard to make those simple decisions here because they seem so ridiculous, you know. And over there, every decision you make is a life or death decision. And so it seems really important and everything is kind of fraught with danger. And, you know, it all seems very, very consequential. And then you come back and it seems – suddenly very mundane and very hollow. And I think that's how jarring it is.
But you also write that leaving was the only time that you got true measure of the place.
Yes. I didn't want to leave, you know. I didn't want to go.
You didn't want to leave. Do you really love Iraq?
No. I mean, I hated it. I hated it when I was there and I didn't want to go and I didn't want to leave. And I think that's the essence of the place. It just tears you to pieces on the inside.
And you've spent a lot of time, 10 years in these areas, reporting a lot of conflict. Do you worry about the physical and emotional toll that's going to take on you?
Yeah. I mean, physical, I'm okay still.
Because you do that running, even if it's 500 yards at a time.
Yeah. And I'm very lucky. You know, I had a lot of close calls over there, as most of the reporters that you'll talk to have. Psychologically, you know, we'll see, you know.
Because I've spoken to a number of reporters who have witnessed really horrific things.
Yeah.
One reporter who watched people, he said, disintegrate at Fallujah.
Sure.
And he wasn't sure whether he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right. I definitely saw a lot of people disintegrate there. And I still think about those disintegrating people. Yeah, they still come back.
Is it possible to understand the realities of life in Iraq only through reading about it without actually going there?
I think, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, that a person's certainty about Iraq, at least for me, in my experience, tended to increase with the distance away from the place. And so, again, not to beat up too badly on the retired colonels who are sitting in the TV studios, but they seem to be more certain than anybody that I knew in Iraq, whether it was military or diplomats or Iraqis or Americans or what. The closer you get, the more humble you feel before this gigantic, sprawling, ever-changing beast that the country is.
Well, when you read news from other reporters, you're here.
Yes.
And you're reading somebody else's report or you're seeing something on television. Do you think that you read between the lines? Do you understand things?
Well, it's different for me, you know, because I've got this whole universe that of experience that I have there.
You say, oh, gee, I ate in that restaurant.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
I know
in
that
the
guy.
Background.
Yeah, and they bombed it. Yeah, absolutely.
In this past Sunday's review of your book in the New York Times Book Review, Robert Stone compared it to Michael Herr's book about Vietnam, Dispatches, which was published in 1977. Did you read the literature of Vietnam when you were thinking about writing this book?
I did. I mean, Dispatches is a wonderful book. Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, is amazing. I think, you know, it's funny. If I had one model for this book, I mean, I didn't have a conscious one, but if I had one, it was probably a movie that was made about 15 years ago called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould, mm-hmm. Who's the classical pianist. And I think if I had a subtitle for this book, which I don't, it would be 87 Short Films About Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, it's a bunch of vignettes. They're not necessarily connected, but I hope when you're done watching the movie, you'll have a pretty good sense of what it's like.
Because we also see in the case of Glenn Gould, we see him deteriorate
yes.
over the years. What have you seen in talking to soldiers, for example, over the years?
Well,
are they relating differently to Iraq than they did after the invasion?
Well, I think the soldiers that I know that I meet back in the United States, I think what we share is a sense of having gone through this thing that most other people can't really understand, you know. And so it's kind of like a weird club, you know. We can kind of communicate with each other with just sort of winks and nods.
But I'd imagine that in the early days when there was a feeling that we had accomplished the mission, and yeah. then, oh, gee, this is not turning out the way we wanted, and then we had real deterioration and people coming back with
yes.
arms and legs missing, and then the surge making a little better, although there
yes.
are still people dying there and still losing arms and legs.
Yes.
Supposedly, I just spoke to somebody who wrote a book about General Petraeus. He tried to correct everything that Jerry Bremer had done wrong when he first came into Iraq and debathified and did all those other things. So are you seeing adjustments being made as a result of what's being – I mean, has the military finally figured it out, for example?
I think so.
Have soldiers' lives been improved as a result?
I think so. I mean, that's a very good question. I think there's been a learning curve. I mean, I think if you go back to 2003, I remember going into to the Sunni Triangle in these villages. And what the Americans were doing then was kill and capture. We're going to kill every insurgent we find, and we're going to capture the rest of them. And if that means going into these villages and grabbing every male between the ages of 18 and 35, we're going to do it. And, of course, what the effect of that was, they did kill a lot of insurgents, but they spawned an infinite number more.
And they killed a lot of innocent people and caused
sometimes
a fair amount of resentment. Well, they were breaking down doors and marching in. And the Iraqis, from documentaries that I've seen, seem to be as upset by what they felt was disrespect for
yes.
women when the soldiers went in as
yes.
anything else.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think there was a lack of sensitivity for the culture. And that's changed dramatically. I mean, I think now if you ask any soldier, whether it's a lieutenant or a captain or a corporal, he's going to say the goal of this war right now, the goal of our mission is to protect the Iraqis and to separate them from the insurgents. And they've basically been able to do that. And again, how long is it going to take? And it's taken 5.5 years and $1 trillion and a lot of debt. So they've gotten it right. The cost has been pretty high.
Has that changed the way the Iraqis feel about Americans?
I think so. It depends on the Iraqis you ask. I was just talking with some Sunni sheikhs the other day out in Anbar province. Now, remember, Anbar province in 2006 was the worst place in Iraq. Soldiers were dying every day. It was the epicenter of the insurgency. And these are the Sunni sheikhs, and they're saying, we don't really want America to leave yet, because if they leave, you know, they're the sort of glue that's holding this whole thing together. And if they take off, the whole thing's going to come apart. You know, now, you know, maybe the American people may not agree with that. You know, that's an American decision to make, but that's what they say.
Well, we opened up the Pandora's box, and now we're stuck with the situation. Part of it is the bad blood between Sunnis and Shiites. The Shiites were oppressed for many years by the Sunni
yes.
minority, and now Maybe they're getting past this, but for a long time they felt now it's our turn.
Yes. I mean, the short answer is yes. And as somebody said to me the other day, you know, the feeling among the Prime Minister Maliki is, you know, the Sunnis ruled this country for 1,400 years, and now we're going to rule. The Shiites are going to rule for 1,400 years. Absolutely. But I think to make another point, which is that when the purpose of the surge, or the premise of the surge, I should say, was is that the typical Iraqi was not sectarian, that the people that were driving the civil war was al-Qaeda on one hand, which was, you know, Sunni insurgents bombing Shiite mosques, encouraging retaliation, pushing the Shiite, ordinary Shiite people into the hands of these militias and the death squads to protect them, who would then go into the Sunni neighborhoods and kill more people, and that if they could shut down al-Qaeda principally and the other insurgent groups that were doing this, they could break the dynamic and they could sort of bring about a pause. And that's what you have now. I mean, you've got sort of a ceasefire.
General Petraeus is now in Florida.
Yes, Tampa.
So do you think the people left behind understand the lessons of his time running?
It's a very good question. I think when I was talking about 2003 and 2004 in the Sunni Triangle, the principal general in the Sunni Triangle in 2003-2004 was General Raymond Odierno, who was the head of the 4th Infantry Division. He had a reputation, and his guys had a reputation for being, you know, the hardest boys in town, you know, and we're going to kill and capture more people and faster than anybody else. And, you know, he's got his own explanation for that, which is, you know, we were in the toughest part of the country and it was really difficult and nothing else would have worked. But he has, he's changed entirely. And you know, I had a conversation with General Odierno just a couple weeks before he went to Iraq at the Pentagon. And he's changed 180 degrees.
Your friend George, who was also a reporter in Iraq, said that he couldn't have a conversation about the country with anyone who hadn't been there. And you told him you couldn't have a conversation with anyone who hadn't been there about anything at all. Well, we're having this conversation now, so what's happened?
I'm a little better. You're talking about my friend George Packer, of course, yeah. Who wrote a fabulous book himself about Iraq called Assassin's Gate. But, yeah, I mean, you come back and you're battered and on edge and kind of crazy as I was.
And everybody wants to pick your brain.
Well, no. I mean, I think that was part of it. I mean, I think it's, you know, wow, you were in Iraq? That's interesting. Well, huh. Did you see the ball game last night? You know, I mean, it just comes and goes. It's like everything else, you know. And, you know, I could drone on about it forever.
You end your acknowledgments with a rather mysterious couple of sentences. I fared better than many of the people I wrote about in this book. Yet even so, over the course of the events depicted here, I lost the person I cared for most. The war didn't get her. It got me.
Right. Yeah. Well,
you don't want us to know what that means?
I think I'll leave it to the acknowledgement. But the you know, war takes its toll. It's really, really, I'll say it's very, very hard to go into a place like this and to come out and to be the same person when you come out. And I wasn't. And that took a big toll on my personal life.
Dexter Filkins will be giving a talk, taking questions from the audience, and signing books tonight at the Strand Bookstore at 7 o'clock. That's at 12th Street and Broadway. And the book is The Forever War, published by Knopf. Are you going to go back again?
I think so. I don't have the burning need to go back like I did before, but now I'll go back as more of a, you know, without the obsession that I had before.
And now you've written the book.
I've written the book. It's out. It's out of my system.
Thank you so much, Dexter, for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
On tomorrow's show, Sichon Sib, the Cambodian-born U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, describes his narrow escape from the Khmer Rouge when he was just a young man. Also, State of the Union is all about Maine. Francine Prose talks about her new novel, Golden Grove. And word maven Patricia T. O'Connor answers your questions about the English language. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Stephen Valentino. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Stephanie Hughes, Alexander Simons, and Paula Crossfield. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening.